It is Thursday, May 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump confirms he reimbursed his lawyer for a payment to an adult film star.
Mr. Giuliani directly contradicted what Trump had earlier said, that he knew nothing about the payment with Stormy Daniels.
A 7-member delegation from Washington is in Beijing to address concerns about China's economic policies as both countries look to avoid a trade war. And a farming legacy leaves a cultural mark on current behavior. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump has confirmed a $130,000 payoff to adult film actress Stormy Daniels shortly before the 2016 election concerning allegations of a decade-old encounter with him. But he said no campaign funds were involved. On Twitter Thursday, Trump said he had reimbursed his attorney, Michael Cohen, in monthly increments after the lawyer made the payment to the porn star to keep her quiet about what she claims was a one-night affair with Trump in 2006, soon after Trump's wife had given birth to their son. Trump said the nondisclosure agreement reached with the 39-year-old Daniels is very common among celebrities, and it will be used in arbitration for damages against Daniels. She has given extensive interviews about the purported affair and claims the agreement is not valid because Trump never signed it. One of Trump's lawyers, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, disclosed the reimbursements to Cohen in an interview Wednesday on Fox News. He discussed them again in a Fox interview Thursday. Alan Lichtman is professor of history at American University here in Washington. He spoke with me about the payment to Daniels.
You know, when you hire a lawyer, you never want to hire someone who wants to be as famous as you are and has as big an ego as you do. Mr. Giuliani is not controllable. He has his own agenda. He has his own interests. And that's not what you want in your attorney. And he's caused untold new troubles for President Trump. Mr. Giuliani directly contradicted what Trump had earlier said, that he knew nothing about the payment with Stormy Daniels. And while no quote-unquote campaign funds were involved, in fact, there is a very strong case to be made that this $130,000 was a campaign contribution because it was designed to protect the candidate from potentially embarrassing revelations that could have hurt his reelection, and as such had to be reported to the Federal Election Commission. And we're not just talking about a technical violation. We're talking about a felony.
And Mr. Giuliani kind of almost got into that a bit, saying during this interview last night, well, if this had come out and this happened right before the election, the results of the election could have been very different.
Obviously, we can't say it would have turned the election, but clearly it would have been very damaging to the president to have this affair come out right before the election at a time when he was already somewhat reeling from the revelations in the Access Hollywood tape and was very vulnerable on this issue of his relationships with women. So clearly this payoff was directly related to the Trump campaign, given the timing and given the issue involved. And if so, it had to have been reported. If it came from Trump, if it came from someone else like Mr. Cohen, then it was an illegal campaign contribution because it vastly exceeded the amounts you can give to a candidate. So either way, there is real legal jeopardy here, criminal legal jeopardy, not just civil.
Today, on Thursday, President Trump on Twitter, he basically was tweeted about this $130,000 payment, saying that he paid money to this attorney, to Cohen. He was saying that this was something that wealthy people do. Kind of in a strange way of, again, seemed to try to spin this.
He is trying to spin it, but there's only so much spin you can do. Money changed hands right before the election on an issue that was very politically sensitive. This wasn't just some rich person, some celebrity randomly trying to protect their reputation. That spin just doesn't work, particularly when Trump originally lied about the payment. Now he's trying to tell a different story. None of his stories are credible since they are based on the crumbling foundation of an initial lie.
Well, in addition, Giuliani spoke about former FBI Director James Comey, and he said that Trump fired Comey because Comey would not, among other things, say he wasn't a target of the investigation. And again, he really sort of waded into more controversy for the president.
He definitely made an already difficult and complex situation for the president worse. This is not, God knows, you know, the 500th justification that we've heard for the firing of Comey. And it just makes less and less credible the claims being made by the president, because it looks like they're just reaching to find something other than the Russia investigation and trying to shut down the Russia investigation as an excuse for the firing. You know, they're trying to throw mud at the wall and see what will stick. And that tactic just doesn't work. This is what happens when your attorney is a loose cannon with an ego big enough to cover an entire ship.
Alan Lichtman, professor of history at American University. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Doug Bernard. So, Doug, what's happening?
What a story, huh? Well, today is World Press Freedom Day. The reason that we know about stories like this is because we have a very free press in the United States, many other parts of the world, but many other parts of the world do not have a free press. There are various limitations, many people talking about it. I thought I'd just give you a very quick little sample here of what people are saying. Here's Rebecca Harms, who's a EU parliamentary member. She says, in Turkey, 179 journalists are in prison to this very day. This is the highest number of jailed journalists in a single country since World Press Freedom Day was established in 1994. Here's Al Jazeera World. The fight for the release of an Al Jazeera journalist continues. Mahmoud Hussein has been imprisoned in Egypt for over 500 days. He is not the only one in Egypt in prison. Here's Stefan Simonowitz. Let's go down to Andrew Marshall here. Here's what World Press Freedom Day means to our jailed Reuters colleague, Hua Long, speaking in handcuffs flanked by police on the steps of a courthouse where the farcical trial against him continues. And then there's a clip there, of course, Andrew Marshall, a journalist with Reuters. And Keith Pochick, again, another journalist, had this to say, but actually he's quoting somebody else. Here's the quote. The only security of all is in a free press. The force of public opinion cannot be resisted when permitted freely to be expressed. The agitation it produces must be submitted to. It is necessary to keep the waters pure. That was Thomas Jefferson, who himself had been argued with the press, but still obviously believed in its intrinsic value. So anyway, just a real quick sampling of some opinion being expressed around the world today on, frankly, a very important issue.
Yeah, very much so. Thank you very much, Doug. That's social media editor Doug Bernard. Here are some of the top news stories trending. U.S. officials indicate North Korea could soon release detained Americans. Pakistan says there will be no deal with the U.S. over the fate of a jailed doctor who helped track Osama bin Laden. And the U.S. charges China targeted U.S. military pilots with lasers. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
There have been reports in the media about a couple of supervolcanoes that are on the verge of eruption. A supervolcano is a volcano that at one time erupted and ejected more than 1,000 cubic kilometers of material. The U.S. Geological Survey says such an eruption would not only have a cataclysmic impact on a large part of the area closest to the volcano, but would also affect global weather patterns, seriously impacting human activity for many years after. A new study led by researchers at the University of Illinois at Urbana, Champaign provides some comfort, suggesting that geological signs indicating a catastrophic eruption would be recognized far in advance. While there have been reports of seismic or geyser activity near a couple of the supervolcanoes, the study suggests that signs of an impending disastrous eruption would be much clearer and longer lasting than anything that has been documented so far. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Catholic cardinals discuss allowing non-Catholic spouses to take communion. Two days of high-level, high-stakes trade talks are underway in Beijing. They're viewed as a last opportunity to avoid a trade war between the world's top two economies. The Trump administration has proposed tariffs on at least $50 billion in Chinese goods over the trade imbalance and Chinese trade policies, including market access, forced technology transfers, and state subsidies. The discussions are being led by U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and President Xi Jinping's chief economic advisor, Liu He. Andrew Polk is co-founder of the Beijing-based strategic advisory firm Trivium that helps investors and multinationals understand China. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty he's not particularly optimistic about any long-lasting agreement, and that is what the market is expecting.
The fundamental or sort of structural challenges that the two sides are talking about seem to become even more entrenched. And so I think the best we can hope for really is some sort of short-term agreement on delaying tariff implementation. But other than that, the real fundamental issues that both sides are focusing on are really pretty intractable. And so it doesn't seem like any long-term agreement could really come out of this two-day meeting.
President Trump tweeted that our great financial team is in China trying to negotiate a level playing field on trade. Is that possible?
If you talk to people in the business community, when they talk about a level playing field, they're more talking about market access issues and operating in China itself rather than selling goods to China or importing goods from China. When it comes to trade itself, it does seem like it would be difficult for either the Chinese side or the Americans to make much movement on what President Trump himself has identified as one of his key focuses, which is the large trade surplus that China has with America. And there's really not a lot of immediate steps that China can take to reduce that trade surplus.
You talked about short-term solutions. An editorial in the China Daily said Beijing wanted the talks to produce feasible solutions to put an end to the ongoing feud. What might those be?
The Trump team is focused on reducing the trade surplus or focusing on Chinese industrial policy to reduce technology transfer and IP theft and things like that. On the former, the trade surplus, like I said, there's not a lot the Chinese can do. And on the second, it's pretty much a non-starter in terms of China adjusting its industrial policy to boost or support Chinese companies. I think when the Chinese say that, what they think that they can offer is some market access issues that we really saw just over last weekend, a host of documents coming out aimed at increasing foreign ownership caps in the financial sector so that foreign companies can own controlling stakes in various financial institutions. And so I think that's one thing that they'll offer. Xi Jinping just recently talked about lowering tariffs on imported vehicles into China. Those seem to be the solutions that the Chinese are thinking. But again, it's not totally clear if that would appease both sort of the wider Trump team, which is known to have disagreements in how they want to approach this, or the president himself, who, like I said, is pretty focused exclusively on the trade surplus issue.
Isn't this issue also about who is going to control the new technological revolution that is coming in the next few years?
From the Chinese side, that's exclusively what it's about. That's really where they are focused. And so they are happy to move on some of the market access issues if that would appease the U.S. side. Their desire to become what they call a technological superpower and to build up technological capabilities so that they aren't reliant on other economies, that's a fundamental drive that they see as, frankly, a national security issue. That issue in particular is the most intractable and the most difficult to get past because, I mean, the Americans as well also see it as a national security issue. So the fact that both countries want to dominate the next generation of technologies doesn't really seem like an area where you can really come to many agreements to say, okay, how are we going to split this up or what are we going to do to stay out of each other's way? Because, you know, once you get into the sort of economic national security questions, neither side really feels like they can give much at all.
Andrew Polk of Trivium. The Chinese foreign ministry downplayed the importance of immediate agreement. A spokesperson said it was not realistic to resolve all issues through only one round of negotiations. Six German Roman Catholic cardinals have held talks with other top church officials at the Vatican to talk about the possibility of allowing non-Catholic Christian spouses to receive communion. Any such move is likely to alarm conservative Catholics who believe Pope Francis is already veering too far from the traditional doctrine. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA from Rome.
German cardinals and other prelates met Thursday to discuss possible access to the Eucharist for the non-Catholic spouses. The issue is delicate, as conservative Catholics have grown increasingly displeased with the liberal attitudes and stances of Pope Francis during the past 5 years. A group of German bishops requested the meeting after a vote in their country's bishops' conference last February overwhelmingly approved a proposal for non-Catholic Christians married to Catholics to be allowed to receive Holy Communion under certain circumstances. On the eve of the Vatican meeting, one German bishop said, "Enough is enough. The time has come to no longer put off a well-justified decision, even if some people still insist on contradicting it." Bishop Gerhard Feiger of Magdeburg said missing a chance like this would be both shameful and macabre. In November 2015, at the Lutheran Church in Rome, Pope Francis said the question of Lutherans receiving communion was one for the individual's conscience. He said non-Catholic Christians share one baptism, one Lord, one faith. At the time, the Pope said, "I ask myself, don't we have the same baptism? If we have the same baptism, then we must walk together." Not all German bishops agree on the way forward. Cardinal Gerhard Müller has called the proposal a rhetorical trick, stressing that interdenominational marriage is not an emergency situation and neither the Pope nor the bishops can redefine the sacraments as a means of alleviating mental distress and satisfying spiritual needs. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. The way your ancestors farm may influence your behavior today. That's according to a new study. The research finds cultural differences between people in China's rice-growing south and its wheat-growing north. The study authors identified those differences by watching people get around chairs at Starbucks. VOA's Dee Barragona has more.
Thomas Talhelm has a theory that rice farming creates a culture of interdependence unlike any other kind of agriculture.
Paddy rice grows best in standing water, so rice villages build irrigation networks to flood their fields. That means rice farmers have to coordinate their water use with their neighbors.
And since rice takes more labor than wheat, villagers often work collectively. Talhelm is an assistant professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago. He notes that while southern China has farmed rice for thousands of years, wheat has sustained the north.
Since this was how the majority of Chinese people lived their life day in, day out for generations, these farming patterns may well have influenced Chinese culture, giving the north and south different cultures.
Talhelm wanted to see if those cultural differences linger in today's urban China, or if modernization had overridden the old ways. He and his colleagues went to Starbucks cafes in two cities in the wheat-growing north and three in the rice-growing south. They put two chairs about a hip's width apart in high-traffic areas and watched how customers got past them. In rice regions, only about 5% of people moved chairs. About three times more did in the wheat regions. Talhelm says that difference is telling.
When people in independent cultures like the United States encounter a problem, they're more likely to want to change the environment to solve that problem.
But in interdependent cultures like Japan, he says, people are more likely to try to fit themselves into the environment, like by squeezing between chairs rather than moving them. Other factors like population density, income, age, gender, climate, or even disease prevalence did not explain the difference. Concordia University psychology professor Andrew Ryder says he would be less impressed if this were the only study on the issue.
You can only learn so much by watching people moving chairs in Starbucks. But once you put this study in the context of the other work that they've done, there's a picture emerging.
He notes the researchers got similar results when they tested thinking patterns among students from northern and southern China. Students from the wheat-growing north were more analytical. Those from the rice-growing south were more holistic thinking. There were even differences among students from rice-growing and wheat-growing parts of the same county. Ryder says it's a reminder that cultures can be quite different even within a single country. Next, Talhelm is testing the theory in India, another country with a big rice-wheat split. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On May 3rd, we observe World Press Freedom Day to raise awareness of the importance of the unhindered flow of information to the public and the crucial role of media workers. It is a sobering reminder that in too many countries around the globe, media workers, including journalists, editors, and publishers, are harassed, attacked, detained, and even murdered for simply doing their work. And publications are censored, fined, suspended, and shut down. It is no coincidence that the less democratic and more authoritarian a country's government is, the harder it works to suppress the free flow of information. That's because a free and unhindered press is often the only institution that can effectively and consistently expose government deception and corruption and keep the public informed. Journalists keep the government and the power brokers honest. Indeed, a free and democratic society cannot exist without a free and independent press. A free press provides citizens with access to knowledge and information, thus safeguarding political systems based on the will of the people. This year's theme, Keeping Power in Check, highlights the importance of creating and maintaining a legal environment that supports press freedom, and the role of an independent judiciary plays in ensuring protections for press freedom and guaranteeing the prosecution of crimes against journalists. Indeed, if the press is to do its job, that is, facilitate the unhindered flow of information that keeps the citizenry informed, certain conditions must be met. These include a legal environment that allows for open and pluralistic media, political will to support that sector, rule of law to protect it, including laws safeguarding freedom of expression, online and offline, media professionals adhering to the highest ethical and professional standards, and a news readership capable of holding them to these standards. On World Press Freedom Day, we show our support for a media in danger of being censored or shut down, and remember those journalists who lost their lives while exercising their profession. And we call on all countries to support press freedom, both offline and online, and to investigate and prosecute all crimes against journalists.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.